I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker, James L. from... All right, hey, listen. James L. is going to come up from Dover and talk tonight. So at this time, I'd like to introduce you, James.
Good evening, everybody. I'm a grateful drunk, and my name is James.
Hi, James.
It's because of loving God and good sponsorship and the lessons that I learned from people like yourself. I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink or drug since June 11th of 1994, and for that I'm eternally grateful. I'm a member of the Dover Group. We meet Monday nights at 8:30, 9 o'clock on Wednesdays, and we hope to see you sometimes, and if you enjoy the meeting, we hope you do, and if you don't, we'll see you in the parking lot. I think Mike, if I remember a while back, it's kind of like the 11th tradition says, you know, we don't like to represent ourselves, but we let our friends recommend us. And I think that how he described me at the day of sharing was about the best way I've ever heard it said in regards to the type of person that I am. I do believe in my heart that I do carry a certain degree of enthusiasm about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think when he described me as, you know, of the way that I presented as an enthusiastic way, I believe that was the way I feel in my heart about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some enthusiasts like ourselves at times pay a penalty for believing in what we believe in, but I believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked. I am not one of those speakers that talk much about the progression of drinking. I know a few of y'all could probably teach me a few tricks on how to bend the elbow. That is not the solution to my problem. I am not one who is, hopefully, I hope not to be blaming anybody in my sharing that makes me want to say, you know, because mom and daddy drank and most of the community by which I lived in was stumbling and puking, that is an excuse for my bad behavior. Because when I got back here in 1994, after 14 years of being what some would like to say a chronic relapser, what I think it was 14 years of pure defiance. From hearing the truth and deciding not to follow the truth as it was laid out for me. Some people qualify by getting into the drunk-a-log thing. I would like to qualify in a different way. I would ask you for a moment if you can relate. I give you a couple illustrations of why I claim myself to be an alcoholic. If you can relate to this, we're probably on the same page. Have you ever woke up in the middle of the night out of a dead sleep? You're sweaty, shaky and nervous, and you reach down on the side of the bed for it. You twist the top, you take a hit, and the next expression that comes out of you is, and you lay back down on the pillow. Can you relate to the idea of waking up in the early days, grab your pants, or if you didn't take them off that night, kind of fill your pocket, and notice that there's a few bucks in it, and a certain sense of security comes about you, and you ain't even put the drink in you yet, just knowing that you have a couple of bucks. Some of us get dressed, and we go out to the nearest facility that carried the elixir of a power that we're looking for. And as you're walking down the street, you start to decide in your mind, how much can I get of this stuff that I need with the money that I have in my pocket? And as you get to those wonderful doors and you open them up and you walk inside and they got all the stuff that we love to use, and you check your money and you grab a bottle of it and you walk up to the counter and you put it on the counter, and all of a sudden you feel a sense of anticipation come about you and you haven't even put it in your body yet. You pay the man and you grab the neck of it, and there's a certain clench around the neck of it that even if God himself tried to pry it from your hand, it wouldn't be possible. And you get to that place where you want to be and you hear that top crack and your mouth start to salivate, and you open it up and your lip get that cup, you know, and you, you start to pour it in, and your whole face just, you know, and it just, boom! Oh, yeah, that's, Y'all relate? If you do, then I'm not going to take the privilege of proclaiming you as an alcoholic, but I am going to admit that James is. And my drinking was not that kind of drinking that came from any specific reason, but I'm going to try to tell you why I think that alcohol works so well for me. Dr. Siltworth said, men and women drink essentially because they like the effects which is produced by alcohol. I honestly believe in my heart that the effects that I got from alcohol worked for me for a long time. And when it didn't work for me, though I admitted to you that it was injurious, over a period of time, I could no longer differentiate the truth from the false. That's why I believe I stayed, even though I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1980, it took up to 1994 for me to be able to receive the truth of alcoholism. Because when I became restless, irritable, and discontent, the idea did come across my mind. And if it didn't come across my mind over a period of time, I could no longer differentiate the truth from the false, because I believed that my drinking life was the only normal one. I would get upset when I would go to the functions and see people drinking with impunity. And I would come into the meeting and tell you I didn't like the way they carried themselves at the wedding. They were all drinking there. The United States government says if you're 21 years old, you have the legal right to drink. I'm not here to tell you anything different. I'm here to tell you that if you're anything like we are, and you're willing to go to any lengths, then you're left between a rock and a hard place. And your choice is simple. You either accept this spiritual stuff that is laid at our feet, or you could continue to drink, trying to blot out that nonsense out of your consciousness. You know the stuff, if it wasn't for them. Because see, my resentment, a lot like most alcoholics, built up over a period of time. History. My mother and father separated when I was 3 years old, and my earliest memory of my childhood was I was in a train station in New York, and I could see my grandmother reaching out for my arm as my mother held my hand, and I could see her snatching me away from my mother. So from the time I was 3 years old to the time that I was 10 years old, 11 years old, I did not know neither my mother or father. My grandmother was the only parental guidance that I had up to that time. My grandmother passed away one night while I was leaning down on the kitchen coffee table doing my homework. She had an asthma attack. She asked me to get her a cup of coffee. I went and got it. I bring it back to her, and I continue to do my homework, and I noticed that Grandma hadn't moved in a while. Now I'm 10 years old or so. And I go up to her, and I tap her, and I notice the coffee spilled on her, and I didn't get kicked or slapped or cussed out. I figured something must be wrong, so I run out the door in panic. Now, this is fear. I'm being driven by fear. I have no answers. I don't understand. So I take off to the first place that I knew, and that was my uncle's house. We get back to the house. They tell me that Grandma had passed away. Now, I don't know about most people in this room, but when you're 10 years old, to comprehend such things at that time were far beyond me. You know, I understood, heard the story of life or death, but to lose the only source of support that I had, it was a lot to handle at 10 years old, and not knowing if your mother and father is going to come for you, or is you going to end up at Uncle Billy's house or whoever's house, and it was terrifying. So my grandmother passed away. They buried her, and then my mother and my father came down together to retrieve me, and I had to make a choice between which two I was going to go. So I chose to go with my mother because, believe it or not, when I look back at it in hindsight, the reason I chose to go with my mother because my grandmother was a female. And I identified that. And I ended up coming to Jersey City with my mother. By the time I got to Jersey City, most of my family in Jersey City didn't know me. So there I was going into a strange environment where people didn't know me at all. My sisters and them kind of shunned from me because I was big for my age, so they felt unsafe and uncomfortable around me. Anytime that my mother wasn't in the house or no adult was around, you know, they kind of like shifted away from me. To kind of tell you what I dealt with, was this was my earliest recollection of what it felt like to be lonely, to be sad. Now, alcohol ain't in the picture yet. I'm talking about those how they call it in the book, emotional bedevilments and upheavals and fears and all that other stuff we talk about. And now I'm feeling that stuff, but I have nothing to fix me. So now between the ages of 10 and 13 years old, I became the kid that stole the drinks off the table, you know, trying to relate and be cool. You know, like when the grown-ups had activities, you lay your Budweiser down, you lay your scotch down, you know, stuff like that. And that went on for a while, and the reason that it worked for me because the kids thought it was pretty funny and it was cool and stuff, and that's how it was in-house. I would say it was around that time where I was trying to have a relationship with my mother. And by the time I was 13 years old, I only really had maybe a year and a half or so to kind of get to know who she was. And a lot of people who know me hear me tell the story a lot. See, I admired my mother. My mother was a good-looking woman. She was raising, at the time, five children at this time by herself. She was a good-looking woman, a charming woman, an upright, strong woman. And she was coming back from an industrial laundromat she was working from, and I used to look at her and just take a breath, you know. That's how I just loved her. I didn't know her, but I loved her. She tried to be good to me when she could. She did the best she could with what she had, and she taught me some things. You know, she taught me how to cook, clean, iron, and sew. My lady's here tonight. She'll tell you those things are true about me, you know, and I still carry that legacy of that my mother left with me. But so what happened with that was so dramatic that made alcohol work for me is after going through what I went through between the ages of 3 and 13 years old, me and a friend was coming back from a public swimming pool. At the time, my mother and them used to frequent a social club in the 70s right across the street from the apartment building that we lived in. While she was there, something must have happened, and me and my friend see the ambulance down the block from the public swimming pool, so like good ghetto kids, we take off to see what's up. So we run down, we get to the building, they're bringing a woman out on a stretcher, her hair is all over the place, one shoe's off, she's kicking, screaming, just talking out of her head, and it was my mom. Somebody had found it necessary to slip a Mickey in one of the drinks, and it snapped her mind. The state of New Jersey found it necessary to put me and three other siblings under the care of an 18-year-old illiterate young lady, while my mother spent over a year in Trenton State Hospital. We went through neglect, squalor, poverty, all kinds of stuff that you read about in newspapers. You know, kids sleeping on dirty mattresses, not having enough to eat. And I got my first job when I was 13 years old across the street at a dry cleaner's. And I would go over there and I would work after school and I would bring a few bucks home and I would put some beans, some fat back, and some biscuits on the table. And by this time now, I am starting to drink. I'm getting the older boys to go into the liquor store to get my Coke 45 and we would roll our little, how do my sponsor make, like they said, better living through chemistry. And, you know, these type of things started to take hold. You know, you're starting to drink your 40s and hang out with the boys. Now, I'm telling you I'm doing it because me and the boys are cool. But the reason that I'm doing it is because I'm full of shame, guilt, remorse, fear, all kinds of those emotional bedevilments that I mentioned earlier. And alcohol and drugs only seem to make it almost okay because it would last for a period of time and it would come back. Most of us that's in recovery, I heard a woman, I think it was a woman I heard say this, that, no, it was a man. I believe Manny remember it. We were at a meeting. Somebody said when they stopped, I believe it was his brother I see in the meeting tonight, they said something that brought a lot back to me. They said when they got sober, it got worse before it got better. And it gave me recall because that's how it was every time that I would drink and then stop. It got worse. It didn't get worse exteriorly, but internally it got worse. And no wonder I agree with the book when it says that, you know, some of us get to the point to where we step away from the God idea. You know, we stop praying, we stop looking for things that inspire us to get through. And so during that time period, I guess that would be the part that if I was like that, I would be sharing that stuff in meetings, you know. To kind of give you an illustration, you know, some of y'all probably could relate getting beatings with belts that been soaked in water. Some of y'all could probably relate getting beaten with stenching cords, broomsticks, matchbox cars, racing tracks, you know, whatever was at hand, you know what I mean? And I would like to come into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you that that was the reason why I drank. I drank solely for the reason that I told you earlier. When it hit the belly of my stomach, something wonderful took place. It didn't matter anymore. So I got to agree with how it works. When I finally reached the point of drinking on a regular basis, I can honestly look back in hindsight and see that I was driven by self-imposed crisis. I mean to be self-propelled. I could see how I was driven not to feel the way I was feeling. And no matter what you told me, no matter what you tried to say to me to keep me from drinking, you don't understand. From ages 13 till I was 18 years old, I felt that I was recreationally using and drinking. I honestly do. I believe that I was just hanging out, you know. I remember episodes when I was 15 years old, me and some friends after school got every doggone liquor on the planet just about, from gin to bourbon, and every kind of malt liquor and draft beer. We sat up on the tracks and drank. And I'm stumbling home in the summer, and my aunt and my mother at the time find me on the bottom of the steps laying in my own puke. And if it wasn't for my head up on the bottom step, I probably would have drowned in the puke. Now, this is normal alcoholic stories. And I would like to sit here and do what I like to hear sometimes speakers do. You know, I drank a lot, then I drank some more, and then they told me that I was drinking a lot. And I recognized that I had a problem with the drinking that I was doing, and I kept drinking some more till I couldn't drink anymore. Thanks for letting me share. Help me here. You know, by the time I was 18 years old, I was told that my condition was bad. I was in the truck with my boss, and he looked over at me. By this time, my oldest son, Marquis, was born. He's about a couple months old, and riding in the truck, and my boss looked over at me at 18 years old, and my hand got a little shake to it early in the morning. And he said, "Boy, you need some help." And by God's grace, Nick put me in my first rehab in 1980. From 1980 to 1994, I bounced in and out after a period of time of being sober. I would literally get up in the middle of meetings and tell y'all can kiss my butt, y'all don't understand, and if you was in my shoes, you'd do the same thing. I remember feeling in early sobriety that now I got it, now I could go and carry the message, and I'm going to go get the neighborhood sober, and the old timers will look at me and say, "They're going to get you drunk before you get them sober. Yeah, you don't understand." And in some cases, like nowadays when I hear that kind of stuff, I understand the difference between what they were telling me then. And back then, I thought it was them that had the problem. See, I thought that I was sober. And I remember thinking that I was in sobriety. And I remember hearing old timers before me talking about, "Boy, you only been here a few months. How you gonna claim it as sobriety? How can you even tell me that you're sober?" You know, because I used to think that I was sober. I had a period of time of abstinence from alcohol, so I figured I was sober. Now, I was physically removed from alcohol, but my mind was still obsessed by the idea that alcohol could do this for me. So, like I said, from 1980, that's the kind of behavior that went on. I'll try to bring us up to date and why I'm here today. It was around the spring of 1994 after I had left the Market Street Mission. February 2nd, 1991, I ended up at the Market Street Mission in a holistic program. I stayed there for 14 months. After about 3.5 years of clean and crazy, I was driving a limo. I was supposed to go 80 west, I went 80 east. I had a conversation with myself all the way down to New York City, all the way up to the point to where I actually put the chemicals and the substances into my body. I argued with myself. 72 hours after doing that, I recognize it's time to go home. I get in the car and I start driving 80 east, 80 west, and I'm crying like a baby because I recognize that here it was, I had 3.5 years of abstinence from any mind-altering chemical whatsoever. And I had just finished using for 72 hours, and I decided to drive a car from the embankment. I ended up in St. Clair's Hospital. They bring me the phone. It's my wife at the time. And the first thing she said to me is, "What are you trying to do, commit suicide?" And like a good alcoholic, I said, yeah. She said, you should have died. I had the spiritual awakening at that moment was that was not as profound as some that we read. But like Bill said, there is many spiritual awakenings in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is people. I'm laying on an examination table and I'm looking at the examination light overhead. Now, no angels came out of it. There was no songs being sung in the room. But I'll tell y'all this, I had the most clearest thought that I ever had in my entire life. And that thought was simple. It said, if I was to stay sober, it was between me and God. Now, I'm standing here and I'm telling it to you, and I can actually feel that remembrance of that moment stirring up on me, and it makes me want to get emotional. And that's what bring out that preacher part of James that a lot of people get pissed off at, you know? And that's fine with me. Because like I told you, in that moment of awakening, that thought was not only in my head, but it was in my innermost man. And I knew then that God could do it. I struggled for a few more months. And on June 10th, which I did not know was AA's birthday, I come home one night and my wife and kids were gone. Now, it wasn't like it mattered that they left. It was just the fact is I didn't want to lose what I had. But it gave me enough of private time where I could ask myself a question. Do I want to continue to go on the way I did? So I called the insurance company. They called some of the local hospitals. They had me before. So they finally found the program that would take me, and they flew me out to California. I stayed out to California for about, I don't know, 2.5, 3 months maybe. And what happened was, while I was in California, what they did for me out there is that I found a group similar to this group, a group that believed that the program was outlined in the first 164 pages. There was a group out there called the Processors, and I got involved with them. And Elton was my first sponsor when I got back in California. Now, I don't believe in temporary sponsorship. I really don't. Either you are my sponsor or you're not. Either I am yours or I'm not. Because if you want a temporary sponsor, I guess you look for temporary sobriety. Or you got that selective sobriety. You know, you didn't do what I wanted you to do, so you're fired. Like I care. You know what I mean? Bill made a statement once where Bill said that the people that he tried to help that didn't get sober, he noticed that when he got home at night that the man in the mirror was still sober. Now, some people may call that a selfish program. I don't. What I call it is a person that was willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, including helping someone who's going to be as defiant as we are. So when I got back here, I met my first sponsor, Lamont B. I was about, I don't know, a month and a half sober now. Well, a month and a half clean. No, I was sober. I was on step two at the time, I thought. And I'm standing in front of a meeting in Morristown, and there was people who remembered me when I had the 3 years of clean and crazy in the holistic program. And they couldn't wait. They said things like this to me. So where's your God now? Where's your Jesus now? Keep it simple, stupid. Look at you. You ready now? And as they pommeling me, I'm looking at Lamont B, and he's sitting there watching these people do this. And because he didn't participate, it moved me. So I went up to Lamont, and I said, Lamont? He said, yeah. I said, how long you been sober? He said, 5 years. I said, have you completed all the steps? He says, yes. I said, do you have an understanding of the traditions? He says, yes. I said, would you be my sponsor? Lamont said, yeah, I'll sponsor you. We went in that meeting that night. He told me not to share, and over a period of time, Lamont started to get me into the early stages of the process of recovery. He had me update with him where I left off, and we started to build the relationship, and the man started taking me through the first stages of the steps. After about working with Lamont for a year or so, I ran into one man I can just strangle. His name is John Stern. John Stern helped me. You know, I like John Stern. Matter of fact, I love John Stern because what John Stern was able to do for James was what many people over a period of time could never do for me. John Stern taught me what true humility was. John Stern taught me that the greatest lesson of humility is being true to thy own self. what you see is what you get. I can live with that. Can you? And I think that when people go up to someone and they see something that is in your personality trait and they begin to play God and say, you know, Mike, do you know me well enough to tell me what kind of man God expect me to be? And then sit in the meeting and tell me what you think of humility. I laugh at you. You know, it's really the truth, you know, because I think that what John Stern did for me is that John Stern took a young man that was full of anger. Y'all heard my story. Y'all know what it must have been like for me. I don't even have to tell you what it was like. I used to sit in meetings and say, my name is James and I'm a time bomb. It was the God and honest truth. I had told people in meetings, when I see you outside, ain't gonna be nothing between us but air and opportunity. And John Stern would say to me, is that the kind of man you want to be? And I could feel my stomach tie up in a knot, because the truth was, I didn't want to be that. But while others were attacking those emotional bedevilments, John Stern tolerated me enough and loved me enough to work through that with me. Not saying that Lamont didn't. The reason that I felt so comfortable with Lamont, and I'll tell you what happened, when that night he brought me in the meeting and he told me not to share, when Lamont started to share, he was an African-American male who was eloquent. Lamont can talk in such a decent manner for me that he just made me go, ooh. You know, I mean, I would look in his mouth as he would use words to describe how he felt, and I didn't know they had those kind of words. The kind of words that I used to use is words that would not be appropriate in the presence of those who don't wish to hear it. They told me people who use vulgarity was a person who had a short vocabulary. Read a book. You know, if I have to stand here at this podium and use obscenities, vulgarities, and obscene descriptions of how I feel, I need to check myself. Because it's very inappropriate for me to talk that way. But if in the parking lot, you may hear me use some language you might not like. You know, I kind of have a spiritual book that told me I'd rather speak a few words that you understand than to speak many words that may confuse you. So sometimes I have to be in Rome when I'm in Rome. So in other words, when I come down, when I got to do a 12-step call that might happen to be in a crack den, I'm not going to go up in there and go, rarely have we seen a person fail. No, I'm not. If I'm with a loved one that's got to go retrieve a loved one, I'm not going to go in there talking that way. I'm going to go in there and say, yo, man, get your blah, 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 up out that blah, 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 and get out the blah, blah, blah door before I put my foot in your blah, blah, blah. And if he decides to sit on his blah, blah, blah after me telling him that, well, the old timer says, we help the willing, we discard the unwilling, and we bury our dead. And nobody likes to let go, live and let live and live one day at a time. I really believe that that's what he meant in the family afterwards, because he told me that that nagging wife pushed that man to go back to drinking. Now, I don't think it was the nagging of the wife that pushed him back to go back to drinking. I think that his inability to put down this new crutch is what caused him to go out and drink. But then it said later on that he continued to drink and smoke and drink coffee excessively, but he wasn't drinking. Now, if that's what you choose to do, however you wish to live, the one thing that we're here to talk about is how not to drink a day at a time. Now I'm finished done and giving my schmeal. What worked for James was when I got introduced to the first 164 pages, it was the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there's a solution, and more about alcoholism, which was my first step. In the doctor's opinion, I was given a diagnosis of my condition. I shared some of that with you earlier. Dr. Silkworth told me that I was an outright mental defective, full of fright from reality and maladjusted to life. For those who don't understand what maladjusted means, the word M-A-L is the word Greek in origin, it means bad. So I would adjust badly to life situations. And the only thing that seemed to work for me was booze. And so he told me that anyone who gave me a message that left out the physical factor has given me a message which is incomplete. So I can agree with early stages of sobriety when you tell me that, you know, don't drink and go to meetings. But those of us who've been sitting here for a period of time know that you're going to have to do a little more than that. But we know that we cannot leave out the physical factor, for we have given you a message which is incomplete. So by the time I got to Bill's story, I was given the first illustration of the alcoholic, of how Bill said that the alcoholic, he felt himself to be normal in every aspect of his life except for when he had to combat with alcohol. And my mind clicked. And I say, ain't that the truth? Because I would get up and go to work like any other normal person. But on a Friday, I would make a solemn oath that I'm going straight home and I'm going to pay my bills. And I would hit that wherever I was going, and you would see me a day or two later, and I ain't got no money. And I would do little things like this. I'd come up to the house and go. And my wife would go, who is it? Me. If you could relate to that, some men in the room, maybe some ladies too. But most of us guys know what it feels like to be so full of shame after making a promise to your significant other that you were going to come straight home from work, and you end up going out for 2 or 3 days and you tapping on the door of your own home full of fear. It's me. What do you want? Nothing. Just let me in. And then I would get in and I would give you, like the book says, reasons that I feel were plausible. Excuses that I thought were good enough. And some of them I even believed myself. If only you went through what I went through. By the time I got to There's a Solution, Bill told me that the only thing that could help me was the vital spiritual experience. And I told you the one that I had. And that's the one that I still hold on to this day. I do honestly, deep down in the core of my being, and my son is here to bear witness to this. The other day, I've been going through a tough week. Holiday season, some emotional upheavals. And my son, me and him was riding today, and he said to me, you know what, Dad, I remember when you said the other day that no matter how tough it get, ain't nothing going to make you drink today. Now, my son bared witness to a statement that I made to him a while back. I mean, that moved me, that he could tell me that. See, I couldn't do that prior to Bill's story. I'm going to say Doctor's Opinion, Bill's Story, There's a Solution, and More About Alcoholism. See, for me, the doctor's opinion was my diagnosis. Bill was the witness of a patient. There's a Solution gave me my prescription, which was the vital spiritual experience. More About Alcoholism, for me, was my relapse prevention chapter. It told me what type of thinking concedes to the relapse. I was given several different illustrations on how the alcoholic end up with a drink in his mouth. The first one was, as some of them, we see some of these little purple, bitter, mean old, just don't drink on the meetings. Butt so tight you can suck a brick out of the wall, you know. And he's sitting there and he's picking on people because he's miserable in his sobriety. That was the guy who said, you know what, I'm not going to drink until I retire. And they said for 20 years this man went without a drink. And when the day came, out came the smoke jacket and the slippers. And in 4 years, he was dead. After putting the drink down for 25 years or so, 4 years later, dead. So everything that he thought he was dedicating to his life or whatever he thought he was going to do didn't pay off because alcohol killed him. I was given another illustration on how I could drink. Man owning his own business, end up working for his business, shows up Tuesday morning, had a few words with the boss, nothing big, you know. I know what I'll do. I'll go down to this diner down the street down here. Maybe I'll find a few familiar faces I can sell a car to. My ego let me know, you know, everybody down there knows my name, you know. I'm going to go to my Cheers and sell a car, you know. And ain't nothing wrong with having a glass of milk and a sandwich. Ain't nothing wrong with it. Ain't nothing wrong with if you're big as me if you decide to have another glass of milk and a sandwich. But there's something wrong with your thinking when you say, you know what, I'll put a little bit in my milk and it won't hurt my stomach. I learned something about that. Resentment could get me drunk. Also, my favorite character is the guy who walked through the threshold and he said, I think I have a couple of cocktails just before dinner. That was how I drank. That's how I drugged or whatever it was that I wanted to use to fix me. I never gave thought to it. I never put up a mental defense. My last relapse reminds me of the jaywalker. For 14 years, I tried to drink the way I thought I should drink. And the last time it broke my emotional back. And then and then least of all is another one of my favorite characters, More About Alcoholism. There wasn't a problem in the world. High on the horizon. Bam, drunk again. And I could see Bill and them doing what people did for me many years over time. Trying to find out, why would I give it all up? We the agnostic, spiritual experiences, and up to where it says God could and would if he was sought was my second step reading. And by the time I got to God could and would if he was sought, because of my past, I never had a problem with belief. See, I was the guy you read about in step two of the 12 and 12 that had a heart full of faith but a gut full of booze. And it turned me into an agnostically inclined individual, a doubtful individual when it came to faith and belief. So I needed the illustration of the preacher's son in weedy agnostic because it tapped into a place for me that I long forgot. I remember going into church wanting to be like grandma and them, you know, wanting to feel the spiritual experience, like we say in my belief system, get some of that Holy Ghost feeling, you know. I wanted to feel that, but I was going in there expecting something that they were working for, and I was delusional about it, and I couldn't get that thing, so I was disturbed by it, so I acted out on my own self-will. And just like it said, everybody got a fundamental idea of God. It told me what alcohol did to me in Weedy Agnostic. It says alcohol was the great persuader. It had beaten me into a state of reasonableness. A little later on, I read, it told me that I couldn't make a living, that I couldn't control my emotional nature. I was prey to misery and depression. I felt useless and I was full of fear. And then I go a page over, he tells me logic's good stuff and I like it. Well, if logic is good stuff and I still like it, prior to page 53, did I learn anything that I just read in Weedy Agnostic? Because in the opening paragraph of Weedy Agnostic, it says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something about alcoholism. So here I am, logic is good stuff, and I like it. And it told me that the reason that I didn't want to do that is because I didn't want to give myself to reasonable interpretation. And so what I would do is I would sit there, and my form of thinking was soft and mushy, and I would throw my hands up in doubt and says, I don't know. And I did know, because as soon as I would get some clarity over a period of time, I would argue with you what was right or wrong. So Bill was right. And then he told me that it was based upon what? Self-imposed crisis. And I didn't want to hear that. And then he told me I couldn't either postpone nor evade. So now after reading Weedy Agnostic and getting that illustration of the preacher's son, when I read Spiritual Experiences, it told me that I could get this all over again if I was willing to become of the educated variety. That was for James. Though I had all this biblical information in my head and standing at podiums preaching the gospel, you know what I mean? And I tell you the kind of shame I used to have. I used to remember, man, they used to invite me to churches similar to being invited to speak here tonight. I would speak in churches like this. And I would be full of God, excited about Jesus. And I'd be looking down at the podium, looking at what this girl wearing while I'm preaching. Is that honest enough for you? Because that was the truth. And there was days that I would come in and couldn't even see her in the room because I was close to God. But here it is now that I'm going through this process of recovery and I'm trying to come to believe. I like the way Joe and Charlie said it. Joe and Charlie said, you could be watching TV and see a commercial that says Tide Ultra Beach will get your whites whiter than white. Is I'm going to Pathmark because I believe that the washing powder will work. I'm going on belief. The second time that I go, am I going on belief? No, I'm going on faith. I know it works. So now here I am in those early stages of the steps, and though I know have an idea of what I believe God to be, I have to agree that we did agnostic. I was living by the God of reason. Because as soon as I would behave badly, the first thing I would tell you, the reason is. And if you didn't believe the reason, I said, hold on, wait a minute. Here's the reason why. And reason put me in more trouble than you can imagine. Because I would go out and steal and cheat and do bad things. And when I would get caught, people would ask me the question, why did you do it? The reason is, and that's how I was driven throughout my life. So by the time I got to God could and would he resort, then I remember him saying anything ran on self-will could hardly be a success. And if you want to, like it says, if you have an honest desire to stay sober, if you are trying to get honest up to this point, you can't tell me you can't identify with that particular statement. Anything ran on self-will. And just like he says, anytime that I was driven by self-propulsion, I always was in collision with something or someone. When I was driven by self-propulsion on a Sunday afternoon to drink excessively and didn't show up for work on Monday, was I driven by my own will to drink heavily on Sunday, knowing I was going to wake up with a hangover on Monday? And just like the character in More About Alcoholism, I had a few words with the boss, but nothing heavy. You know what I mean? Where was you on Monday? Well, the reason was, you know what I mean? And I lived like that for a long time. So by the, you know, most of us who are big book enthusiasts know that by the time you get to page 62, you become somewhat angry with the book now. I don't want to read this part. You know what I mean? Selfishness is self-centeredness. Who you talking about? Me? You know, and prior to being told that you were the actor trying to set up the play, you know, you kind of brushed that off, you know. But when Bill tell you, based upon the decision that you made in the past, you set yourself up to get hurt, it starts getting ugly now. And then after that, he beats you up a little more, and did he do that prayer we just did a little earlier? And now I got to bend my will to something that I've really had difficulty with for a long time. I'm not here to tell you that I know what God's will is. But this I know to be true. Since June 11th of 1994, it has been in the will of God that I stay sober. And that's the truth. I know that without a wavering of a doubt. Because I know that James cannot stay sober on his own power. I can't. I told you for 14 years, I always lost. Alcohol always won. And just like that little description that you get in the first pages of in A Vision for You, it did get blacker and blacker every time I took my butt out there. I have to understand that. So by the time I get a little further into the book, now I'm facing looking at step three stuff, and we all know that for me, I like what the 12 and 12 says. It says in the first couple of steps, all we did up to this point was reflect. Now I'm at a decision point. I have decided that the same Jesus that they were picking on me about in 1994 when I came back to the rooms is still my higher power. I said, that's my higher power. They might not be yours. But I am not afraid to talk about my God. Now, I'm not going to preach to you right now because that's none of your business. You may not be concerned about what I believe in, but I'm telling you that's my belief. Now, I took that belief and it worked for me. And it's a concept by which I can agree upon. I ain't got no problem with it. Now, I ain't your perfect example of a Christian. Trust me. I sin every chance I get. I mean, but the truth is that I'm looking to mature. See, and in some areas of my life, I'm still quite immature. Especially in areas of the God-given instinct that I never really took time out to deal with, like sex, security, and society. I think the greatest writings of the 12 and 12 is Bill's four-step writings, because Bill takes and breaks down the God-given instincts for life. And he tells me how my character is in the sex area, how my character is in the security area. And he broke the security area down for me where I can actually see it for what it really is. See, I have insecurities like emotional insecurities, but I also got monetary insecurities. You know, when the car starts going clink, 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 I go, oh, God. Oh, boy. That's going to affect my financial security. I'm not going to be able to get to work. And I become full of fear. And then the people that's close to me, if you can't seem to help me get through that fear, I start getting emotional insecurities. Aren't you going to take me to work, Mike? Mike goes, I got to go to work. You know, you better find some other arrangements, you know, and on and on and on. And when Bill broke it down that way for me, but the greatest one of all for me was the social instinct. And me and my brother Manny talk a lot about this. When we came back in 94, we had difficulty with fellowship. We didn't get a lot of fellowship because we were angry, young, vital, vicious young men, and people didn't invite us to the diner. When the meeting was over, see, it's funny now, but it wasn't funny then, you know what I mean? And so all they left me with was this blue thing, you know. I had to read the thing. They don't want me to talk about the blue thing. It's the truth. And what happened was I wasn't getting brung to the diner and told, you know, hey, James, just hang in there, man. Just hang in there. I was more like, have a good one, man. And so when I met my brother Manny, like it says in the fourth step of the 12 and 12, when it came to brotherhood, I had small comprehension. And me and this brother been on an 8-year journey in the time that I've been here, that Manny's my brother. He's past a friend today. And I can say I have fellowship with that man. I see a few other faces out here that are part of my network, that I also can see them as brothers and sisters in recovery. Truly brothers and sisters. These people have done some things in the past couple of years in my life that if I was to get to talk about what they gave me, would bring tears to my eyes. And I'll probably feel sissified after I did it. And my ego sometimes don't want me to talk like that. I'm going to get a little sensitive, you know, and in the fifth step, what it was John Stern was starting to teach me that humility thing I was talking to you about. John Stern in my fifth step helped me not to exaggerate and dramatize my fourth step. My fourth step was not complicated. It was a simple four-column inventory. The name, the cause, how I was affected, and that ugly, ugly one, my part. And in my part, John Stern was able to take a look at it from an objective point and to let me know and see where my behavior has caused me the problems of my past. If you notice, after I told y'all in my qualification about why I drank the way I did, you notice I ain't harping on the fact that my mother died of alcoholism and AIDS. I'm not harping on the fact that my sisters and some of my siblings and family members are still drinking themselves to alcoholic deaths. I just buried a cousin a couple of months ago who drank herself to death, and she also, like my mother, died of alcoholism and AIDS because alcohol put down their inhibitions and they slept with the wrong partner and they received the HIV virus, and because they didn't take care of themselves, they died young. My cousin Elaine died at 41, and my mother died at 51. I got good reason to feel like I could come in the meeting and flip over the table. You don't understand. The truth is that I believe, like I said earlier, when I talked about my belief system and my shortcomings, that I am not the best example of Christianhood that you can ever look at, is because that's the truth. I really would like y'all to look at me in the shirt and tie and see me all cleaned up since I stopped drinking, to have an idea that I am the perfect example of humanity, and I'm not. What I am is one of God's babies who's trying to learn to live a day at a time. I didn't understand that until John Stern did a fifth step with me. Because some of those things that I was talking to y'all about, I had to look at it in a certain way that made me view it from my point of view and the pain that it caused me, that any time that you would talk to me about it, it would stir up, just like Bill said. I would squander away hours trying to explain to you how messed up my life was as a kid, when I could have been using that time somewhere else. Me and my lady were sitting down the other day and we were looking at the big book and we were looking at that part where it says that fear should be classed with stealing. And that's what my past can do to me. My past can make me be so full of emotional fear in my relationships with other people that I would actually be stealing away from other people. You know the people I'm talking about, the ones that got that big emotion straw and they see you and they just run up behind you and stick it in you and go. And when they finish with you, you're just laying in the bed like a vampire just drained you of blood, you know. And you're like, oh, God, you know, somebody give me an IV or something, you know. You know the ones I'm talking about, and sometimes it's me. And John Stern wanted to make sure that I wasn't feeding off of other people. Bill says in Interaction, how many times have we tried to get our comfort at somebody else's expense? How many times? Ouch. That hurt me. So now by the time I got to step 6 and 7 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill told me to emphasize the willingness to change that kind of behavior. That's why the paragraph's so short. Ain't nothing to it. If I know that I'm treating you badly and you tell me that I'm treating you badly, I need to make a conscious choice. Am I going to continue to treat you badly that way? Or is you, and knowing that I treated you badly, Bill already warned me. He said, they seemingly hurt me without provocation. Because see, whatever it is I think I'm doing to you, I don't think it's that bad. And now when you retaliate, I'm wondering, why did you do that? See, because I never took time out to think that beautiful golden rule we were taught when we were kids, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now I punch you in the face and wonder why I got a split lip. You know, that's what I mean behavior-wise. I'm not saying in a physical sense. Step 7 is my favorite of all the prayers, because what it did to me is it allows me to take all of me to God, both good and bad. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but all my life, throughout my childhood, I always thought I had to be good to get good. Now, I understand the illustration when they tell me in meetings, you know, you do good things happen. I mean, that's, like Bill said, logic is good stuff, and I like it. I know if I live to the best of my ability to be as decent as I can be, good things will happen and come along. But I also know the reality of life, that no one's outside of life's tribulations. Things will happen. And that's the part that I have to take to God when I feel betrayed by a friend. And why is they treating me this way? I didn't do anything to them. And I really want to physically take you out in the parking lot, or I really physically want to take you out in the clearing in the woods and thump it out with you. But I can't do that because John Stern used to say to me, you are not allowed to act badly because someone else did. And I'm sitting there, and my stomach is so tight that I can actually feel the acids in my stomach coming up because I'm restraining myself not to do something that I would normally do. So no wonder, to me, that's me personally emphasizing the willingness to change the behavior that I used to have. My MO in the streets was, if you say one more thing to me, I'm going to punch you in the mouth. Win or lose, I took a shot at your lip. You know what I mean? And when I look back at that past behavior, I can see that all I really wanted to do was prove my point. So no wonder by the time I get to step 8 and the 12 and 12, it says I should step up sharply to see where the toss pot is calling the kettle black. You know, my brother picked me apart on that many a day. Me and my brother were sitting down the other day, you know, and once in a while we'll call each other and, like, you know, I'll tease him and call him my higher power because he always straightened me out. And he said something the other day that was really funny that made me remember, you know, how God-like we can be. He says, you know, I would say, oh, my God, but all I do is say, oh, me, you know. And when he said that, I understood what he meant, because it says we must stop playing God or it kills us. You know, and we have those little recovery cliches we usually shoot at each other that's of, I guess, of little experiences that we had in the room that let us identify what we're acting like. And can the toss pot call the kettle black? I know that most of us here, and the book says that we did not like to be told that we were, you know, we were emotionally messed up, that we were grandiose, and that we were oversensitive. We didn't want, the psychiatrists of that day didn't mean to hurt our feelings, but they did when they called us that. That's why I told y'all in my shortcomings that the only excuse that I have for it is that I'm immature in certain areas of my life. And it'll probably be in those areas that you will see my glaring defects. You will not see my glaring defects in my stronger areas. Like anytime you want to go out in the parking lot and argue big book, I'm ready. And then my sponsor humbled me one night. Because see, I've always stuck my chest out on spiritual matters. And I misplaced something, and my sponsor asked me to practice something that I stepped away from for a long time. My sponsees enjoyed it though. But it put me back into a place of knowing that I am no spiritual giant anymore. And I'll tell you what happened, if I may. I was having some difficulties in life situations, and I needed to get closer to God on it, and I wasn't getting any answers. And being the Jesus freak that I am, and you know, if you just like the big book, if you want to argue the Bible, I'll see you in the parking lot. And there I was, thinking that the way that I was going about it was going to fix it over time, and he gave me a particular practice to get what I needed, and I'd never been approached by anybody that could put me in my place in that area. Not that he meant to do that. I don't think it was intentional for him to make me feel like that, but that's how I felt, because I got an ego, as you can see. And when he said to me to practice this particular approach, I kind of took me back a minute. But when I shared it with my sponsees, they reminded me what it was like to be a sponsee again. I praise God for that. Thank you. And I want to say that to a few of them in this room tonight, that I thanked them that night for laughing at their sponsor and making fun of me. How I feel.
You should.
And from that day on out, I've been dealing with the earlier struggles that I told you over this holiday season. It was because of those things that were given to me, I found another way. And sometimes your way might be better than mine, but am I willing to listen? So I have to finish up the step thing, and by the time I got to step 8, I knew that the list would be painful for me, but I had my list already written in step 4, and I looked at it and I took the actions. And there's some things that I did in my 9-step work that I'm quite, you know, boisterous about. I like to talk about them. One of my sponsees and I were not arguing over it, but when we say argue, it's like Socrates and Plato, you know, sitting on a rock, you know, that kind of thing. And I remember shooting to him, don't talk prudence when you practice evasion. If you're at step 9, keep that in mind. When it's time, handle your business. Oh man, the book is right. When it pays handsomely. And my sponsee called me up and he shared that experience with me. And was I surprised? No. while he was talking, I was like leaning on the other side of the phone like, yeah, I know the feeling. And he's like, hey, man, you know, and wow. And I was like, yeah, that's that sounds about right. And that's the kind of network of people we have. We hear those kind of experiences on a regular basis. We hear people that's sitting amongst us that has like 4 months sober, and you hear him talk about his fifth and sixth step. We were sitting in the meeting. A guy said to my sponsee who was sharing one night, he says, don't you think going through the steps in a year is a bit too fast? And in my mind, I'm thinking, like, thank God he didn't ask me that question. You know what I mean? Because the first thing I would have told him is how soon you want to get better. You know what I mean? Because, you know, it's not an issue of how fast or how slow you do it. But then, you know, it's a matter of how willing you are to get better. Because I haven't found anything that worked as good for me as the steps. Step 9, my favorite part of step 9 is the part that I love to hear in meetings. Like, I always hear the promises, so-called, in meetings. But there's a sentence before that, which is my promise. As God's children, we stand on our feet and we crawl before no one. If we're painstaking about that phase. Because, see, I don't know nobody else in the room other than myself that feels better that I now have a backbone. Now, if somebody said to me, what did you try to do, commit suicide? No, I thought about it, but no. Because, see, I didn't have a backbone back then. And you could say to me and do just about anything to me that could throw me into an emotional bedevilment. And I would get all messed up and everything, and I would get all caught up in it, and all those things that was talked about afterwards I couldn't get a new freedom and a new happiness, because all I could think about is what you just told me I was. You know, I couldn't see how my experience could help anybody. And it was all because of that 9-step work of stepping up to people and saying, you know, what can I do to make it right? A lot of times in our network, what we talk about a lot is restitution. You know, I can't go and steal my mother's TV, and then just because I got sober and I come back and I say, hey, Mom, what can I do to make it right? Mom might say, take your butt to Kmart and get me another TV. And I'm looking at her going, but I just got sober and I don't have any money. She said, well, when you get me another TV, then we'll be all right with us. See, I'm always looking for them to look at me and go, I understand. See, because if she really asked me why I did it, I got a reason. Because reason was my God for a long time. Step 10 is good stuff. You know, I like the I'd rather the step 10 that I read about in the big book. I understand the one in the 12 and 12, and it got some good principles in it, but the big book helps me a lot better. It tells me that any time that I ever ran into difficulty, that there was something I could practice as much as I want. And that was to say, not my will, thy will be done. And the book says, for this is the proper use of the will. Anytime I'm driven by something so hard that I can't get my way, I can always stop and say, not my will, thy will be done. He said the proper use of the will. So that means that somewhere down the road, if I could get to that point, I somehow may not know what God's will is, but I'm willing to be in it. I might not like it, but I'm willing to be in it. And it's the reason why I have to be so continual about taking an inventory of myself, because it is only in those places that he mentioned that I was disturbed. Every time there was a picnic or a wedding, I felt like, oh, watch out. Your disease outside doing push-ups. And as soon as you say where, they look at you, well, you're a wise ass? No, I'm not being a wise guy. Why you want to keep me in a delusional state of mind? See, step 10 helped me not to be so delusional about what had happened, because I took a spot check inventory of it. I could go on, but I'm about towards the end of the hour. Step 11 for me, still, just like all the other steps, is good, but I like the way the big book approaches it again. It tells me to look for self-seeking motives, see where I could be of service of others. It tells me that more action is at hand. And the one thing about it all that I like about step 11 in the big book is that it told me to stay away from morbid reflection and that doubtful stuff. You hear it. Man, it's so hard to stay sober. Why you feel that way? You should be excited. Oh, that's easy for you. Well, it told me what to do. It told me to improve my conscious contact. Those of us who are excited about being sober and having a relationship with God, most of the people I come in contact with that feel that way are excited. You know, you ever seen somebody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that has worked on their relationship with their higher power? They're active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and they're working with others. A lot of them seem to be somewhat excited. They may not be jumping and doing flips, but they have a certain look in their eye that they're, this is good stuff. You know, like honest, the truth is, I make fun of this a lot. I said, you know, people who refuse to have a conscious contact with God, I'm waiting for the day, and I love the way Barefoot did this, man. This was funny. He said, I'm waiting for somebody to come in the room with a bloody butcher knife in his hand. I just slaughtered my whole family, but I'm not drinking today, and I'm a winner. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the truth. You know, you hear him come in, and it's about the fact that I'm not drinking. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, my carrying the message in the carrying the message group is this. I did not come here tonight to tell you that I stopped drinking and that's the message that I carry. The book calls it a two-stepper. I'm not one of those. I had an opportunity to participate with this group in some activities in the past. And in closing, I want to say that, you know, keep the enthusiasm up. Because people who decide to follow the program as it outlined, just like any good soldier, is going to find war. And sometimes surrender is the best way to win a war. You get to live another day. Book told us that the triumph was a short win. I don't have to prove to you today that I'm sober. I know I'm sober. And like my higher power says, if those who do not believe me, I know that my testimony is true because I have a slew of witnesses. Our founder says that our testimony is so convincing that we believe that no further authentication is necessary. That's what I believe. I believe that our program has its advantages for all. I like to close by saying if I have said, done, behaved in a manner at this podium which was unacceptable to you, I ask your forgiveness. My brother liked to tell me that that's not a good thing, but I like to put that out there anyway. Because the point I'm making is that if I've done something to you that might hurt you, just let me know what I can do to make it right. If you're willing to do that, then I'm willing to make it right. But if you're not, then I'll see you maybe Monday at Dover, Wednesday at Dover, and if that's not helping you, I'll see you in the parking lot. So if nobody told you they cared for you today, remember that I did, and my name is James, and I'm a drunk. Thanks.